I also had like a little group of friends, the people I looked up to who had always talked about doing things with computers. I don't know that they ever described themselves as like quote unquote hackers, but they were people who I kind of looked up to as peers. You know, Offcrack also came out in the early 2000s. And so that was kind of another representation of this tool that you could download, and it would do this really interesting security circumvention for you.
Sup, cyberspace. This is Lorenzo Franceschi Bicchierai, and today we have a very special episode of Cyber. Every month, I'm going to interview a famous or infamous hacker who tells us about the first time they pwned a computer. Our first guest is the very badass Emily Crowes, who used to work at the Pentagon and the NSA. She now works for a company that protects critical infrastructure and promises to safeguard civilization. Welcome to My First Hack. Thank you, Emily, for being here. I think it's your first time on the show.
Hard not to have been on the show before when it's the first one of the show.
It's the first for everyone here involved, so that's great. Tell us a bit about what was your first hack?
Oh, first hack. Okay, so first hack. So I've been asked a question like this before a few times, and the answer, you always expect to have like a really cool answer for this one. Like, oh, you know, I got into some super secure database or something. It wasn't that way for me. I don't know how many people it actually is that way for. But my first one was just playing around with Back Orifice 2K. And the victim was myself. I self-infected with Back Orifice, and it took me a while to figure out what had happened. But when I did, I actually still got a chance to learn the software. So it wasn't a total loss, but that's just kind of how you learn, I guess.
Yeah, so this must have been late 90s, early 2000s, right?
Early 2000s, yeah.
Yeah, so how did you, like, what brought you to, like, what motivated you to essentially self-hack and learn about that software?
Yeah, this was in high school, and, you know, you go into high school and you're trying to figure out who you are and what kinds of groups you want to hang around with. My dad was in computers, so I had some kind of passing interest, I guess, in computer technology, but I didn't know what I was doing with it. All I knew was kind of what he told me. And this was coming from a time when like pop-up ads were a really big thing and everyone was trying to get around them. And there were all kinds of little things that would get on your computer just from standard browsing. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of like my intro to the more technical side of how computers are supposed to operate, was just looking through the registry and figuring out what, if there was like a piece of malware or something that would change a registry key, that kind of helped me understand what was going on in the computer at the time. But I also had like a little group of friends, the people I looked up to who had always talked about doing things with computers. And I don't know that they ever described themselves as like quote unquote hackers, but they were people who I kind of looked up to as peers. And although we didn't spend a whole lot of time talking to each other about things like computer security, we still got an opportunity to kind of exchange a few ideas that would give us at least some encouragement to continue doing what we were doing, although it was not impressive stuff at the time. Mm-hmm. Or now. It was just a very like very early attempt to try to understand what security was all about back when I was probably like a sophomore. Mm-hmm. Or a junior in high school.
Yeah, and obviously these were the times when you know, I guess even the term hacker wasn't as loaded as it is now. There weren't like cybersecurity stories splashed on the headlines of the New York Times every other day.
Right.
And as you hinted, like these were times when just browsing the internet was relatively dangerous. I mean, most of the time it was just, you know, malvertising, I guess we would call it right now, although probably at the time it wasn't even a term. But you could genuinely get hacked and get infected by malware just going to the wrong website.
Well, yeah. And this was also, don't forget that this is like, this is pre-router days in a lot of cases. We were using, we had 56K in my family for probably less time than most people, but we were still using dial-up into the early 2000s. And so everything was like, you had direct IP connections to everybody who you were communicating with. So like, it was even more dangerous back then.
What could go wrong?
Without having network address translation to kind of at least give you some level of protection.
Yeah, let's just talk to each other's IP address directly, right? You know, what's
that's fine. Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, what could go wrong? So you had like a friend of like a group of friends. You mentioned that you don't know if they were even calling themselves hackers. I'm curious, like, is that a thing that at the time, like, were people, you know, in BBSs or IRCs calling themselves hackers, or was it just more, you know, like right now on Twitter, you see a lot of people saying, oh, I'm a hacker, I'm part of Anonymous, whatever. How was it back then?
Well, yeah, I think it was always kind of that way. Yeah, there was, at least among my friends, there was certainly a certain amount of like, There was nobody to tell you that you were or weren't one. So if you wanted to give yourself that title, of course, you could call yourself whatever you wanted to. So there was no restriction or regulation on who could call themselves what. So we just kind of, if you were dabbling amongst the people who I was talking to at the time, it was fine to call yourself whatever you wanted to. I think there became kind of a stigma about calling yourself a hacker, just because the term wore out its usefulness, I think, at a certain point. So culturally it kind of like dipped. I think it kind of stayed down. I don't think that people still really describe themselves in that way. At least most of the legitimate people who I interact with, I don't think they would call themselves really like hackers, as an identity anymore. Maybe ironically, but yeah, I certainly wouldn't put that on my business card.
Yeah, I feel like for some people, it's a thing of the past. It's something that they used to call themselves, and it's some people like maybe see it as like a youthful thing. Others don't like it anymore because it's gotten some negative connotations. But yeah, it's not as simple. It's not as common to see anymore. So did you have a hacker name at the time?
Yeah, I did. I don't want to say it.
No self-doxing.
It's not so much about the doxing. It's just a really awful, it's just not a good name. So
it hasn't aged well. That's fair.
We kind of tend to, it's not spicy or anything. It's just not a well chosen, it's stupid, like a childhood thing. I think a hacker handle or like a name that you come up with for yourself tends to be like wearing a coat, in my opinion. It's like something that you put on and it represents a time and a place, but eventually you've worn the coat long enough and it just kind of like maybe gets some holes in it, or you just get, it's not part of your style anymore, so like you just take it off and you throw it away. It's kind of the same thing with like a name. Not a lot of people kind of keep the name that the original name that they gave themselves. Some people come up with permutations of it, but it's, yeah, when I take off a name or an alias, that's gone forever. Or at least I try to make it gone forever.
That's good OPSEC, I think the Grok would say. So good job.
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah.
So to go back to Becca Orifice, like how did you, I know that at the time it was kind of a big story, I think, especially in DEF CON circles, and the CDC, the Cult of the Dead Cow, made a big deal out of it. And part of the whole story about the Beck Orifice was how much of a big deal they made out of it. You know, they made a big announcement. It was all about denouncing Windows' lack of security. So how did you come across it, and why did you think it was a good idea to use that software on yourself?
So I didn't intend to use it on myself, Lorenzo. I should point out this was an accidental self-infection, is the technical term.
So a self-pwn, I think.
This actually, yeah, you'd be surprised how often this happens. It's not a thing that people will talk about, certainly. But, you know, even professional developers these days, you just run the wrong thing in the wrong place and oopsie doopsie. So it's not necessarily like you mean for this to happen. It just does. But how did I come into familiarity with Backorifice? I think it was probably somebody among that group of friends who recommended it or was talking about it. I don't remember exactly like what year that was exactly. It might have been 2001 or 2002 that I got kind of took interest in it. But so it wasn't like immediate. I wasn't super tuned into what was happening at DEF CON or anything like that. It just kind of like made its way. The news made its way to me.
And so who were you trying to hack? Was there a target? Was there a plan? Or is it something like you were bored one night and you're just like, let's try out this?
Yeah, no plan. Never any plans. Just trying to learn about it. Yeah, this time was kind of the early representational time when people were making tools and making them publicly available that would do offensive things. Like, people always shared techniques before. Connect to this phone number for access to a protected zone or something like that. Or something along those lines. You know, Offcrack also came out in the early 2000s. And so that was kind of another representation of this tool that you could download, and it would do this really interesting security circumvention for you. And so having access to that, now it's all over the place. You know, that we've evolved from having just a few really good tools to having an entire website like GitHub that's out there for tools that do all kinds of different things, and some tools that do the same kinds of things, and some do them better than others, and others don't do them well at all. But this was a time when you didn't have a broad spectrum of tools that you could reach into and do these like security type of activities, offensive security activities. It just wasn't developed out that way.
Yeah, this was just to put the listener back into that era. Like, this was not a time where companies would share open source security tools on their GitHub for marketing reasons. I mean, these are really the early days of InfoSec and hacking. And so I'm curious, actually, like, how easy was Backorifice to use? Because I wasn't paying attention back then. And as you said, like, things were much more complicated in many ways. So, like, how did you go about actually using it?
So that was like one of those tools where you had the intention, you would put it on your computer, double click it, and it did what it was supposed to do. So the delivery of the tool was really, I think, a little bit more difficult. At least this is kind of my recollection of it right after what's it been, 20 years. So like, you would have had to have physical access, or I would have had to have, somebody like me would have had to have physical access to a machine to run this in any kind of offensive, like legitimately offensive way. I probably could have run it on one of my family computers and played around with it. In fact, I think I did at one point, just kind of put this on a different family computer just to mess with my dad or my sister or something. So to the extent that it was like a targeted activity or something that you could easily run, was just, that was the limitation for me as somebody who was very early in my development of these types of skills.
And what did you learn from, both from your first self-pwn, so to speak, to, you know, playing around with your family computers?
One of the things I learned from that, I think probably the biggest lesson that stuck with me, is that everybody participates in security to some extent, even if you have just a little bit of interest and maybe even just a tiny bit of skill. And I'm not even saying that what I have was skill. I have the ability to double click a file and run it, right? So I doubt, like, download the right thing and then double click it and run it. So it really brought the technique concepts down to a level where you could just run something and interfere with it. That gave me an immense amount of encouragement and motivation to learn the more complex things later on that I just didn't have at the time. And so by no means was I ever at this point like a highly skilled, highly technical individual. I didn't have the ability when I was a teenager to like rip through the really nitty gritty parts of a registry. Like I could certainly search through a registry and figure out what kinds of keys were there, but I didn't necessarily know what they all did. And so the whole kinesthetic, the touching part of computer security was something that I had to develop after I had already started with a tool like Back Orifice.
So would you say that like that was like a very important part of your development as a hacker?
Oh yeah. Yeah, certainly.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that it was Back Orifice in particular, because I think a lot of people these days don't realize how important that tool was in the history of hacking. I read the book from Joseph Mann this year about the Cult of the Dead Cow, and there's obviously Back Orifice and Back Orifice, what was it, 2K, the second version?
Yeah, that was the one I was using, yeah.
Yeah, those were like huge for hacking culture. And not just hacking culture, like I heard rumors that like some of the, you know, like for example, the hacking team's first product was heavily based on Back Orifice. It was basically a copy paste and then some added you know, customizations or whatever their customers needed.
Yeah, and that's kind of what's interesting. I think about a lot of the people from my generation of hackers. I'm just saying this as a for lack of a better term. We had there's always been a culture in the hacking community of sharing information. And so like right around the time that I was starting to experiment with things in computers, we went from sharing just raw information to sharing like tools and programs. And this to me was kind of like a very notional jump in the history of computer security, going from just like having a very dry sense of this is how this system works. And if you do something in this way, then you'll be able to break the security of the system. There's still a lot of that. In fact, I would say that the most technical components of at least offensive security these days have that component in them, that ability to like tear apart a specific system component and figure out which part does what and what is exploitable. That's what gets people past, you know, the OSCP or one of these certification programs that are very popular right now. So it's much less tool based, and I think eventually we kind of culturally we started to tune out people who got to the point of using tools and stopped, right? We call those types of people script kiddies. Mm-hmm. Like they're able to pick up a tool and use somebody else's tool, but they could never develop their own, or they don't. They're maybe still in that learning phase. It's kind of a loaded term, but you get what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, and the flip side of that is again this sharing culture that back then was somewhat different to now. Part of the point that the CDC wanted to put across, I guess, was you too can hack Windows because it's this easy, you know, right? Like you can just use this, and Microsoft is not giving a damn. So, do you think that was really like, were you a little scared at how easy it was to hack with that tool, and has it changed really?
I think to some extent back then, I didn't really, you don't always realize that what you're looking at is as bad as it is, especially when you don't have like the high level view of what's good and what's bad. And in terms of security, it doesn't really, it didn't immediately set off this like, oh my God, I can't believe that they would, why would you do security like this? It certainly seemed easy to, you know, run a tool like Back Orifice. But there was always something that would, in my experience, would make it slightly more complicated to just use it liberally, right? So like in the case of Back Orifice, one of the difficulties I always had was trying to figure out just notionally how I would run this thing on a computer that I didn't own. And then you get to a certain point, at least I was a good kid, right? I was such a good kid that I didn't want to get in any kind of trouble or anything like that. So I never got to the point of like using any of the ideas that I had to run this on someone else's computer who I didn't have permission. But you have to go through the motions of figuring that out. It's not just, you can come up with the ideas, but proving them out is always the challenge. In hacker parlance, we have a proof of concept is the thing that everybody wants to get to. But when you have no education and you are trying to learn things from the ground up, there is a certain amount of like experimentation that you have to be willing to go to in order to learn that next thing. And sometimes there's risk associated with that. And in my case too, it was hardware limitations as well. I just didn't have enough computers, right, to like play around with all the different things that I'd really like to have.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
What was the next step then? How did you go from there, you know, to play around with this software to getting on your way to become a professional like you are today?
So it took a lot of time and it was very incremental. It was so incremental, it's hard to tell you like exactly where I went after that, right? So like, I think I started getting into IRC and I was looking at different networking concepts. So I was really learning the very basic stuff back then that I would use later on. So like being able to run a trace route. And one thing I remember was like this guide on how to figure out where your connection was being routed through. So you would like run a trace route and see which nodes your connection would hop through as you went to X site. And so that was like probably one of the things I did after learning about back orifice and running back orifice, is just kind of figuring out how networking worked. Because if you wanted to use this somewhere else, or if you wanted to learn more about somebody who you were chatting with, maybe you would have to learn some amount of networking to get there.
Do you think that that's been lost a little bit? Like sometimes I see people saying that the best way to get into InfoSec is to just learn the basics of networking and learn the basics of computer science.
Certainly, that's still a thing that I think is one of the barriers to entry to being a legitimate computer security professional, is learning how the inner workings of something like networking works. It's really difficult in this day and age to be good at that to be good at computer security without understanding how packets go from point A to point B. So in terms of learning that type of information, I don't think that's been lost. There is a certain ethos, I think, in the hacker community that is maybe not lost, but has possibly been diluted from when I was, you know, going through my discovery phase. And I make it sound so sordid, discovery phase. That period of time where you are poking and prodding and doing things based on just pure curiosity and not knowing anything, and maybe having like a very limited technical manual and technical knowledge for this thing you want to learn about. I think there are people who still get into it through that, but there's definitely more formalization now with education. And I think that's a great thing. But the trade-off there is that there's less time focused on learning something that has no documentation. Or yeah, it's hard to describe, I guess. It's more of a feels versus a feels over reels thing is what I'm trying to describe here. And I could be wrong about this, but it's not like I'm not pining for a time where people have less access to information, but there is a certain like hard scrabble nature, I think, that comes from not having the information and learning it from the ground up that may be harder to attain when you have all the information in front of you and it's just a matter of finding it.
Yeah, maybe it's something that's hard to quantify. Like it limits creativity in some ways, or it can, I guess. You know, it doesn't have to necessarily. But a lot of hacking, as you said, is just, you know, pressing buttons and see what happens.
Yeah.
And I don't remember who it was. I think it was Patrick Wardle, actually, one time told me that, you know, his he was talking about him disassembling or reverse engineering a malware, and he said, you know, I'm not really a reverse engineer. I'm not trained as a reverse engineer. So I just ran this malware on a VM and looked at what it was doing.
And I've met Patrick a couple times. He's a great guy. The thing that struck me when I first started talking to him, when I first met him, I think at ShmooCon maybe 2 or 3 years ago, was exactly what you're describing. Like this guy is just a really curious nerd. He's definitely still got that very, you can tell this about some people. He's still got that childlike wonder about things. And it's very easy to see how he could just get lost in some obscure thing, you know, in a weird niche component of a Mac or something like that, you know, but that's why he's good at what he does, in my opinion.
So how did you go from, you know, from this to like working to the government and now being in the private sector? Like, is there a lesson there for the youth, you know, for young hackers getting into the industry? What would you tell them?
Well, I went the lace curtain, college bound version of getting an education. And, you know, when I went to college, my initial interest was in doing history. So I was initially going to be a history teacher. And then I realized, you know, I kind of would rather make history or be a part of making history rather than just talking about it all the time. I still definitely like doing that. I spend some of my side time, my personal time doing this kind of research. And it's definitely still interesting as a hobby. But when I was in college, there was a moment where I had to make a real tough decision about whether to change my major. And that's kind of what I decided to change and do what I'm doing now. So when I was at Eastern Michigan University, we had a program that had just started up when I was there for information assurance. It was one of the few college programs for information assurance at the time. I don't know if they still do it, but the NSA had this thing that they called the Center for Academic Excellence or something like that. So Eastern was one of these places. And so I think NSA funded a certain amount of programs, a certain amount of classes or some such thing at my university. And I took some of those classes, and that's kind of how I got into working for NSA after I was done with college.
I feel like that's what you want, right? If you're a country that wants a mature like cybersecurity program, and you want to know how to use these tools in geopolitics and etc., like you want that kind of outreach to young people, right? Looking back, do you think that there was a good thing for your career, and do you think that the NSA should be doing something like that? Because I know that it can be controversial for some people.
It's definitely something that I recognize as being controversial now. I still think it was good for my career. It definitely gave me an opportunity to kind of get into a job that was interesting to me and learn more about what I was interested in. Like, not everybody who comes out of college has a full depth of information, unfortunately, in what they're studying. So when you get to the job, the workplace, sometimes you still have a bit of a buffer period of time where you need to learn some more about what you're doing. And to do that in a space that allows for that is really important. It was important for me as a college graduate to have that place where I could understand a little bit more about it without getting myself into too much like work-related trouble, as in like, you know, show exactly how little I knew mm-hmm. at the time. And you might think of like an agency in the government as being really not a great place to learn, but it was for me. So that was my experience, was more in the way of being able to and having access to more education and learning opportunities. And so all of that was great for me.
And this was like, if I'm not getting the time wrong, like this is a few years after 9/11. Did that play into your wanting to be part of history rather than, you know, witnessing it?
I don't think so. There may have been a certain amount of like nationalist interest that I had at the time for doing, you know, giving back to my country or some idealistic thing. But I definitely, that changes over time. I definitely still like being an American citizen. It just didn't push me into that place. Having a national identity wasn't really the main driving force for getting me into government. It was more, I had this really interesting opportunity that I felt like I needed to pursue. So, it was all secret and everything was, you know, it's hard to describe that feeling of like, it was just pure excitement. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that makes sense. And I think it's interesting that for a lot of former NSA or, you know, just government people, after the Snowden revelations have, you know, are relatively shy to talk about it. Whereas in countries like Israel, you know, saying that you're from Unit A200 is almost like a requirement, right?
Yeah.
Like you don't get a cybersecurity job in Israel unless you, at least it seems so, right? From the outside. Like I can't tell you how many emails I have from PR saying, hey, do you want to talk to this person? He's a former A200 grad. Whereas in the US, it's not as common. And I feel like as a journalist, I feel like that's kind of it may be unfair. I think it's been, you know, 5-6 years or maybe 7 years now from the Snowden revelations. And I think that, you know, I think we should come to a time where like we don't look at former government employees under a negative light just because of the revelations that Snowden put out.
Yeah, you know, I understand the skepticism. There's a certain amount of, like, whenever you have secrets or when secrets are involved, it's very difficult to be straight up with people about things. And so I understand the public's sentiment about people who used to work for the government. You know, I as a private citizen now, I definitely have my feelings about how the government conducts business, but I've found different ways to, you know, like I write my representatives a lot, like a lot. That's because I'm still working within a system that I, you know, inherently I still believe in to enact change. And I think that was kind of the difference between people like me who worked for the government and were faithful to the promises that we made and people who weren't, is that the belief in that system. And that is the thing I think that disconnects a lot of people in the public from the way that government just does business in general. And yeah, it's something that if you haven't been on both sides of that coin, it's difficult to understand why things work the way that they do. But I definitely think there's room to improve for the government in particular.
Yeah, and I guess what I was trying to say, it's also that, like, I don't know if there's a, like, for a young, like, a college grad who's interested in InfoSec, I don't know if there's many places that give you more chance to grow and learn as a government agency. I mean, sure, you could have maybe gone to a Silicon Valley startup and there is a different kind of learning there, but it's just a different mentality, different incentives, different pace. Yeah, I mean, there is a reason why a lot of people take that road.
Yeah, it makes sense. It worked for me. It doesn't. It's not a thing that's going to work for everyone, but it certainly worked for me.
And now you got us to close the circle. Now you have left the government and you are in the private sector. How's that transition been? And can you tell us a little bit about what you do now?
Yeah. So when I left government, I went to work for Keith Alexander's company. So that was where I was in 2017 when I got out of the government. So instead of, you know, working for General Alexander as a member of the National Security Agency, who I worked under him when I was at NSA, I was working for him in his own company. And that was also for me, culturally, it was a very soft landing to be around a lot of the same people who I'd worked around when I was working in government was a great experience. And to also kind of like to continue doing work that I felt was important was also kind of just a really big, that was a really big part of why I chose to go where I did after my government experience. So I spent a couple years there and then I moved over to where I'm at now, which is a company called Dragos. And we do industrial security. So we're protecting networks that service factories, that protect the electrical grid, water, just all kinds of different industrial purposes.
Critical infrastructure. Yeah.
What
would you have said if someone would have come to you, like in the Back to the Future, and said, you know, in 20 years, you're going to be defending like nuclear power plants and whatever?
Yeah, I probably would have said like, well, she's going to have to improve her math skills. I was never a particularly good math student. So, that was kind of like another thing when I was younger, was this idea that I was never going to make it anywhere because my skills in my academic skills just weren't that. I was always like a very average student. I felt like I'm self-taught in almost everything that I know. So if I'm not learning it myself, if I'm getting this information from a class, like it's not quite the same experience for me. So I definitely would have been surprised to know that I was doing anything that was as fulfilling as my work is right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. And I guess, do you still use Back Orifice once in a while, just for the old feels? Or
been a long time. It's been a real long time, but I
don't know if it still gets updates, right?
I don't think that it's supported anymore. But you know, the cool thing now is that I'm in contact with a lot of the people who were doing this kind of development back then. So there's a certain amount of like meeting your heroes arc to my story and my journey through security that's been really fun for me. So like one of the tools that I always used to use when I was younger was Offcrack, because it was kind of like I would just forget a password or get frustrated with my computer. And so I would just have Offcrack on hand. Or when I was working in the help desk at Eastern Michigan University, it was the same deal. Like we would get a computer in that we would have to re-image, but we couldn't do it without having Offcrack. So we would use this tool. And then a couple of years ago, I'm talking to Mudge now, and Mudge is like a personal role model of mine. So there's, once you get into the circle of security, legitimate security people, there are so many interesting people doing such interesting work in this industry that I can't imagine really doing a whole lot else. You always get that urge to like find some other thing, but this is what I've been doing for over 20 years. So it's tough to imagine doing something else.
So did you end up getting better at math?
No. Nope.
See, that's the lesson here.
I'm still terrible at math.
See, you don't need math to be a good hacker then.
Well, it helps. It certainly helps. There have been times where I wish I was a better math student.
Well, it's never too late.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Emily. This was really fun. Always great catching up with you.
Oh, likewise.
Looking for inspiring stories? Listen to the EY Leading Into Tomorrow podcast. It features compelling stories from leaders across government and the public sector who've transformed their organizations and services. From the impact of grants to how digital innovation is reshaping affordable childcare, you'll get actionable insights and ideas that can be used around the world. Download Leading Into Tomorrow by EY wherever you get your podcasts.